back to another exciting episode of Extra Features Energy. We have a fabulous guest. Well, actually, we owe it all to Chad Meisenheimer. He introduced us and said, I need to watch this film, but Chad doesn't make any films in 2 years, so I hope he hears this and hears that shot him. We got a fabulous director whose new film, Where Sleeping Dogs Lie, Josh Pearson's here. Thank you for coming on.
Oh, yeah, man. I'm really, really happy to be here and excited about it, man. So, and, yeah, Chad, what's up with that, dude?
So let's start at the beginning. I mean, you seem very much influenced by gangster films in the past, I would say. I see a lot of influence in here. So let's start there. Like, is gangster films your favorite genre, or is just this is what you wanted to write about?
Oddly, no. I don't think it is my favorite genre. I think my favorite genre probably is adventure films. And, like, you know, from the 80s and 90s adventure films, like Indiana Jones, Gremlins, Goonies, that kind of stuff. And Jurassic Park was, you know, a massive influence on me as a kid. But I think when I hit my teenage years was when I started writing a lot more. And as far as screenplays go, because I learned how to write my first screenplay when I was in the sixth grade. And it was actually my English teacher that, yeah, that gave me, he gave me a screenplay. I forget what it was now, but it was a short screenplay. And I just started writing then, like really heavily writing screenplays. And then I started also getting a hold of movies like Mean Streets, Taxi Driver, a lot of that kind of stuff. And started kind of gravitating more towards crime. And I like that it can go any which way you want. And then when Guy Ritchie started hitting the scene in the U.S., you know, in the early 2000s, it was pretty amazing to me. Him matched with Tarantino and Scorsese. It was just kind of a really cool melting pot of stuff.
So when you're writing your indie film, you have a lot of stuff going on in your film. Like, it's nonstop. We're over here. We're over there. I find locations are really hard because I think this may be your first film. I don't know if you've done another one. You didn't send it to me, so that was a mistake there. And let's start with the thing. Like, you have a bar location that you shoot at a lot. You're in the bar, out of the bar. I presume you shot all in one take, like one day, and just edited to amuse me.
Yeah, so we shot – it was – the bar scene was – it was two different scenes, and originally I wrote it as one scene. And when I started going through and editing it, it just – that scene just drug and drug and drug and drug, and I was like, oh, God, what am I going to do with this thing? But, yeah, locations are a funny thing, but Sacramento is an interesting place because, you know, the film scene here really isn't – a lot of like, business owners and stuff like that don't know that they can charge. Yeah. So they're like, hey, you're making a movie? Cool. It's going to be, you know, potentially on Amazon or potentially on Netflix or whatever. And they're like, that's awesome. That's just great promotion for us. So we were able to get into the bar for free. But there was a caveat. We had to shoot from 4 a.m. to 10 a.m. And that's all we had for one day. And I mean, that's a – and those two scenes are a big chunk of the movie. I mean,
they're a lot.
Yeah. So there's shots I wish I had that I don't have. But at the same time, we powered through it. And those guys did great. I mean, they had all their lines down. I warned them prior to it. You know, we sat down a couple of times and just talked through the scene, talked through exactly what I wanted, where I wanted it, how they were gonna deliver each set of their lines. When we went in there, we were just as prepared as we possibly could be just to get out of there, and we basically shot it in about 4 hours.
So then you're at 8 a.m., so it's time for breakfast.
Yeah, basically. And it was funny because most of the movie, about 80% of the movie takes place at night at that house. So, and there's a lot of reasons that we had to do that, by the way, but we shot weekend nights for about a month and a half. And that bar scene, we only had it available to us on a Sunday morning. So we were shooting all night Saturday night, left there, and went directly to the bar and shot there. I mean, it was brutal,
okay.
To say the least.
You brought up the house, which I was going to get to later, but sorry, we can start with the house. That house is massive.
Yeah.
Who do you know to get the house? Like, that thing is a mansion.
So it actually isn't. That's the coolest part about it. So you notice we never show the outside of the house.
No.
And I did that for a reason because we never show the outside of the house, and we never I never show you how we get to one location of the house from the other. So I see people, I have people coming and going from like the kitchen or from hallways, but you never see where they came from. So we were able to pull off cheating each room almost. And we had to do it that way because if we didn't, the house actually, it's a big house, but it's not like mansion size. So we had to do our best to be able to try and cheat some of that stuff and figure out how we were going to place people the right way and place the cameras the right way. So it didn't, so we could play it off as being a bigger house than it actually is.
Okay. We can't let everything go. Like, if I'd be upset if we didn't discuss the strip bar.
Yeah. So
how do you get to walk into a strip bar and go, "Hey, I need to shoot some topless women. Is that okay?"
So the funny, that place is funny. So, I went into every strip club in Sacramento and every single one of them told me no. And then one of my buddies is like, "Hey, you remember that really kind of shady one that's like out there off the beaten path?" I'm like, yeah, I remember that. He's like, "I think they'll let you shoot in there if you just pay them." I'm like, "Oh, okay, cool." So I go in there and this lady is in there and she's like, "Yeah, just give me $200 and you can use it for the morning and that's it." I was like, "Okay, cool. What if I need girls?" And she's like, "Well, each girl, they'll charge you separately." So they basically charge you their, like, lap dance rate type of thing. But we ended up using, actually, a friend of ours, that Bunny, who knows how to dance on a pole and stuff like that. And she did a great job.
So that didn't cost her any money?
Yeah, we ended up paying her. But that was just basically, like, a day rate type of thing, because she's also an actress.
Okay,
and then the strip club cost is like $200, I think.
I just want to go back to one more location before we move on to something else. Yes. That car dealership, did you pick the ugliest cubicle or whatever you could find? That is a scary place.
Man, so originally we wanted to shoot it up. I don't know if you've ever been in Sacramento or Sacramento area or not. So there's a town called Auburn that is about an hour 15 minutes from Sacramento. And that's originally where I wanted to shoot. It was because it was closer to the house that we were shooting in. And Auburn is a smaller town. So it's got a small town kind of feel to it. But when it turned out, we really couldn't do that. We couldn't travel a lot. It was just getting harder and harder to move people around. So we ended up finding this place in Sacramento. And it was like, it was the funniest, weird, like, the guy that runs it is this. It's hard to even explain. Have you ever seen Porky's?
Yes.
Like that. He's like Porky.
Okay.
So, like, he's got the, you know, that swagger that Porky had, and like the big Cadillac. He's that kind of guy. And when you walk in the place, we ended up taking a lot of stuff off the shelves and everything. But when you walk in the place, there's like all these old school like newspaper articles about all these people that he's met over the years. Like, he's met presidents and all kinds of other people, but the place is dingy as hell. And it's just funny, man. It's just a funny little place. But, you know, we wanted to make the movie feel overall like you didn't know what year it was. You notice there's no cell phones. The cars are a little bit dated. There's a few other things that we couldn't get past, like some of the cars in the beginning of the movie and stuff like that we had trouble with. But when you're operating with no budget, it makes doing a period piece really difficult. So all the locations, we really wanted to kind of either dress them up or make them – or have them look kind of older.
I thought the movie was shot maybe late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
I definitely got that feel, because not everybody has a cell phone then.
Yeah.
And if they do, it's probably not charged, or they don't know where it is, or it's somewhere in one pants pocket. But before we leave the car dealership, I made a note. Barry's boss's office. What the hell is going on? Speakers, a bowl, stamps. Everything's on this guy's desk.
So that was the guy's desk that owns the place.
Oh, my God.
And so we looked at the desk, and we're like, I don't think we need to move anything. And so there were a few small things like memorabilia type of things that he had on the desk that we took off because we didn't want his name to be there. But other than that, we just kind of kept it the same. It was super dated, super duper dated. So loved it. It was kind of stayed.
Okay, I want to discuss some of your acting choices, especially the guy that wears the black Laval and glasses. Has he ever heard of contacts?
That's funny. You know, I haven't been asked that question yet.
I'll take that as a positive.
I think, you know, it was definitely a choice on his character and wanting to show his development a little bit. Because you never really get the feeling that Barry, that's his name, the one with the glasses, you never really get the feeling until about midway through the movie or a little bit more than that even, that he's got a criminal background. And I don't want to give too much away, but basically, like, I wanted him to be kind of nerdy, down on his luck, and I felt like the glasses really, those big, bulky kind of 70s, 80s glasses kind of show that this guy doesn't have a lot of money. He, you know, can't afford to really upgrade himself in a lot of ways and is just kind of hanging by a thread. At least that's what I thought when I saw him.
Well, I think you could say that. I think you present that again in the bar seat. One of my favorite lines is, he goes, "Don't we have a tab? You don't." It made me laugh. I thought that was really well done. Going, this guy's a slap. Even the bartender doesn't like him.
That's probably one of my favorite lines too, actually. And because you start seeing him crack at the seams a little bit in some of those lines until he finally does just crack. But yeah.
So, are your main lead guy, the tats, are they all real or did you have somebody put them on him?
I'm sorry, I totally missed that question.
Your lead man, the guy that we get introduced to that sets everything up. I'm trying to be vague, obviously. Yeah. Tats on him, are they hand-drawn or that he's really covered in dust?
They were actually tattooed, like just fake tattoos that we took off the internet. And then I had our makeup and effects guy, he ended up printing them on, I forget the kind of paper it was, but he was able to print them out on the paper and basically use them as fake tattoos. So they basically apply to your skin the exact same way that fake tattoos apply.
Now, how long do they stay on him? Does he have to walk around for 6 months with these on him?
No, I think they started rubbing off about, they were like a week, week and a half, because we were going weekend to weekend. And I remember that he had to have them reapplied, like on the ones on his hands, and I think the one on his neck, they had to reapply every week or two. It just depends on like high friction volume areas.
Now, doing night shoots, did you have an exhaustion rate for yourself and your actors? I mean, doing night shoots, you got a 40-hour work week, I presume, at your regular job. Yep. Then you're like, okay, honey, we're going off to shoot again tonight. You know? I mean, how is that shooting night after night after night and then going back to work?
So me and Courtney, Courtney is my fiance, and she's also co-producer on the film. She's the executive producer on the film. And, you know, she's the one that really pushed the movie forward to begin with. And we both look back at it, I think, and I think it's the most trying time in my life. I've never gone through anything that was so hard ever. And, you know, when people ask me, how do you go from making a short to making a feature and making it good or somewhat good at least, you know, I don't even know where to start half the time because it's so much more work than making a short film. But those nights, I distinctly remember, and I don't think I'll ever forget this night, but I think we were 2 weeks in, I think we were either 2 or 3 weeks in, but I think we had already done 4 or 5 days or something like that. And it was like 3 o'clock in the morning. The guy that was doing BTS, he had actually fallen asleep on the stairs behind me. And I'm like kicking him to wake up. And then like the scene was going so well that I forget which scene it was exactly, but the scene was just really moved me. And I was so tired. It was like a Saturday night. I hadn't slept. And the bad part was that like, we were basically not sleeping on the weekends because, you know, you come home from that at 7 a.m., 8 a.m. and you're just wired. So you're not really sleeping, and then you're getting ready for the shoot, you know, a few hours later, because you're leaving at, we were leaving at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon to be able to head back up the mountain to be able to get set up and all that stuff. So it was really tough. And then come Monday morning going to work, me and Courtney especially, we weren't able to really start sleeping normally until Thursday night. So we got one good night of sleep and they do it all over again. But going back to that night, I will never forget, after that scene was over, it was like, it was that moment where you realize that you're making something bigger than yourself. And, or at least that's how I felt. And we broke for lunch or dinner, or whatever the hell you would call it, at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I grabbed a burger and some stuff, and Courtney's trying to talk to me and other people are trying to talk to me, and I can't really focus, and I can't, like, nothing was really computing in my head. So I was like, look, guys, I got to go outside. I just got to get some air. So I go outside and I'm sitting outside and I start crying, like profusely crying. And I think it was like that moment where it was a culmination of lack of sleep, not being able to really, my motor functions were like just going away. I couldn't really compute everything that was happening. It got to the point in the middle of the night where I was like having to rewatch those scenes over and over and over again to make sure that I was getting what I wanted, because it was just too much. Like I couldn't, my head just couldn't do it all. So when I walked outside and I just started crying, and like, then Dustin, who plays Barry with the glasses, he comes outside and he walks up, me and him are really good friends outside of film. He walks up to me and he just like grabs me and hugs me. And he's like, dude, we're doing this, man. We're doing this. We're actually doing this. He's like, we can't turn back now. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. I don't know how the hell we're going to finish it, but we're doing it.
Okay. I'm going to beat around the bush a bit, but you'll know what I'm talking about. You have one character that's pretty confined for most of the film. Were they really confined, or was that all just smoke and mirrors?
Oh, really confined.
Really? The whole shoot really confined?
Yep, the whole shoot.
Do they hate you?
Well, the funny thing is, though, that our first shoot day was actually the last scene of the movie.
Okay.
And that's the only scene where he's not confined, right?
Correct.
So we started off all nice and happy for him. He knew what he was getting himself into, though. He totally knew what he was getting himself into. I don't think that he realized that it was going to hurt as bad.
Well, that's what I was thinking. I'm like, that looks painful after a while. So I'm like, maybe they loosened them up. But you're saying, nope, 100% nope. Tight.
The whole time. And I mean, there's tricks that I learned on this shoot, you know, from our effects guy to try and take some of that pain away. But at the end of the day, when it's like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and you're that tired and, you know, you're getting things ripped off of you and stuff like that, it hurts.
Fair enough.
He was a trooper.
They also have a scene, a woman falls.
Yeah.
Okay. See, I said I'm being very vague here. I'm doing well.
That's awesome.
Did you put a cushion behind her, or was that a straight fall? I was wondering if she was padded. Because you kind of do a quick edit there. Because I figured there was a pad I never saw. Because it's like, fall, edit.
Yeah, so that whole scene is actually a little funky when I went back to edit it. Because there's a lot more to that scene that we shot that I didn't use.
Okay, so tell me about what we didn't use and we can talk about it. Because I'm interested in what I missed. Because I thought the edit was a little quick for me. And I just wanted to know, there had to be more, I thought.
There was. A lot of the reason that I didn't use it was because it just didn't look good.
Okay.
A lot of it was because the way she was moving and the fact that she's running and then, you know, we have what happens to her happen. And it was really tough to pull off. I don't think we were prepared to pull off that type of scene. The way we should have been, but independent film, it's just one of those things, you know, it's, you're kind of flying by the seat of your pants and trying to make things work.
Of course you are. That's why I'm asking you these questions. How do you get around these things?
But it's funny cause I love wide shots for a lot of reasons. And there's a wide shot that's missing from that scene. That's basically, it's in the entire scene that's happening. And I took it out because it looked like crap, to be honest with you. Like, it just wasn't, we didn't have enough lights. And because she was running through the woods. And so we didn't have enough lights to be able to light all the woods that we had there to be able to get the wide shot to look good. But
I'd like to have seen that. If you could get that, that would have been an awesome shot. I know exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah, I love the shot itself. It just looks bad.
I could see that. I mean, you're going to need a lot of lighting. Because, I mean, you show me the woods for like one quick second.
Yeah.
And then something happens and they talk about it.
That whole scene is much larger written than it was from the edited version. I love the scene itself. I really wish that we could have done a little bit more with it. I wish that we could have been able to go back and actually reshoot some of that stuff. But schedules and things like that, we just couldn't make it happen. But it's funny, like, we had one wig. So when she falls, I got one shot at this thing. And
really,
then it's done.
That's it?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. So how's working with blood? Because, I mean, there's a lot of blood in this film at times.
It's so funny you mentioned that. Like, so you're not the only person that said that to me. And when I looked at it, I was like, the first time I watched it on the big screen there was about 40 people or something like that in Vegas. That was our first showing. And I had people asking me about the blood, and they were like, there's a lot of blood in this movie. And I'm like, really? I can totally go for some more. Like, when I wrote it, I was like, man, I want more blood. I want more blood. I want more blood. But I think that working with it is interesting. That's really my first time where I kind of just sat back and watched what our effects guy was doing and how he was doing things. And I have nothing but the utmost respect for these guys. I think that what they do is really, really important, obviously, for film in general. But it's also that they're also training and teaching the entire cast and crew, because everybody's got to be prepared for what's going to happen. Because, like I said, you might only have one chance at it. Well, so it's interesting, and I think it's cool, super cool.
So let's discuss your fetish of trunks and putting people in trunks.
Oh, trunks. It's funny. I used to have a fetish with wrapping people up in plastic in my old short films and stuff like that. You'll notice on all my old short films, I wrap somebody in plastic or like a tarp or like a carpet in one of them. I think with this one, the original script, there's a little bit more to it where you actually get a little bit more of the bad guy and what's happening. And a little bit more preamble up to it. So you start to understand why people are in the trunks. but I like the idea of the confinement. I like the comedy behind it too. Because that, I know which scene you're talking about in the garage is, to me, every time I watch it, I still laugh. It's just one of those things that just makes me laugh every single time.
Well, that reminds me of saying you had to have the right size actress, I guess, or actor for that scene. I guess I might be in trouble there.
Yeah.
Does it fit in the trunk, or did you measure it ahead of time, or you're like, yeah, that'll work?
So that's actually a funny thing, because so when we were looking for cars, I was like, okay, I have this really nice house. I need a fairly upscale car, but it needs to be like 70s, 80s-ish. And then I ran across this Jaguar that I'm like, it's actually in really nice shape, and the guy only wanted like $600 for it, I think. And it was in great shape. Like, what you see in the movie isn't half of how good that car looks. And the funny thing is the electronics in the car don't really work all that well. So like, things would open and close on their own, and like, it was really funky car. But I now own this Jaguar, by the way. But we were like, I was more or less looking for the car. I wasn't really caring about how difficult it was going to be to shove one actress into it, let alone two. But it turned out that the trunk was massive, because it actually had a mat in it at the bottom, and the mat was like taking up like 6 inches or something at the bottom of the trunk. So we pulled the mat out and we're like, oh wow, this thing's huge.
Did any of your actors complain about wearing a mask constantly? They look hot in some scenes.
Yeah. all the actors, all the crew, all of us complained about halfway through shooting. We're like, okay, next movie, no masks. Because, so from the actor standpoint, I think it could be hilarious to hear actually what they have to say. But I know that Dustin and Jesse used to complain about the masks because it's like, one, you don't know, when you go on break and things like that, we didn't have enough people to really be managing all the props and everything. So like these guys were having to track all their stuff down and they would leave it places and they'd have to find it again. I have a scene where at the end of the movie, because we shot it first, there's a shot, one shot. And I don't know if you noticed it or not, but there's one shot where Barry with the glasses isn't wearing his gloves because
I missed it.
Yeah. I don't even notice it. That's the funny part. Courtney noticed it. She's like, he doesn't have his gloves on. And I'm like, what are you even talking about? I don't even notice it. But he noticed it too. Dustin watched it. And he was like, I don't have my gloves on. I'm like, how are you people seeing this? But the gloves and the masks were awful. Awful. I would never suggest that to anybody to have gloves on, gloves and masks on through almost 80% of a movie. It is the most god-awful thing. Because then we also realized that, well, we were shooting it basically in like late spring, early summer. And Sacramento is hot. So at night, it's like 80 degrees out up there. So these guys are sweating, like profusely sweating. So we're having to dab them. And then we realized, well, wouldn't they naturally kind of be sweating anyway? So we kept having to go back and look at the footage we were shooting the weekend before. And then since we were shooting out of sequence, I was kind of made the call second weekend. Okay, let's just start spraying these guys with mist every single shot that they don't have their masks on, because it's just going to make it so much easier in the long run when we're editing, just for continuity's sake.
So I want to discuss music in your film. You seem to be very specific when you use your music. You have it in the bar, and then I don't think I hear it again until the end of the film.
Yeah, I think, and you're talking about like the band music, right?
Yes.
Like, yeah. I don't really, it's funny that I don't really know. I went back and listened to it and was like, would I have liked to have other like metal or punk or whatever somewhere else in it? I think so, but I love like Jeremy Saunier movies. I really like his style. I like the music that he uses. I also, Nicholas Winding Refn. I like that he uses it in shocking places, or in places that, like band music, or in places that it doesn't really, like, drive the movie too much, but it's just there. But the funny thing is about the music in the bar is that if you listen to the lyrics, it's talking about people that we love and screwing them over.
Yes.
And what you're going to do next and how you're going to deal with the situation that you're in. And it's funny that even happened that way because like the bar music, well, all three tracks actually are friends of mine. Oh. And they were like, you can use the music. I don't care what you use. Just go pick something off the album and use it. So I just listened to the stuff and then finally realized that it fit really well. But the rest of the music through the movie, that was all original stuff, all original score stuff, I didn't want the music to take over any scenes. I really wanted it to just kind of be ominous in a lot of ways. If that answers your question?
Absolutely, it does.
Okay.
Now, Les, before we let you go, because I know we've talked a lot, not mentioned anything about your film. I think we're doing really well.
Yeah, dude, you're doing great.
casting. Casting is always a big, hard issue when you're an independent filmmaker. I mean, obviously, you have so many friends, and I don't think all these guys are your friends. Maybe they are, and it was easy. So let's discuss casting. How is it? You got to have a certain lead. I mean, Dustin works perfectly for his thing, but you have two other guys. You have the young new guy, which I think works well, but the main guy is the guy I want to discuss. How did you find him?
So Jesse, we posted, so we did read-throughs. So after I wrote it about 4 years ago, and then we did a bunch of read-throughs with friends and family and things like that, just to kind of, you know, iron out the kinks. And then when I finally posted it locally for looking for talent, I knew that the movie wasn't going to work without the three right people for those parts, because it is a little comedic. It is also dramatic. It is also, there is some action in it. So these guys have to be able to have a lot of range. And Jesse, when he, so let me back up actually. I originally wrote the movie for me to play that lead.
I knew it. Because you're not in it. I looked. I'm like, no fat in it.
Yep, I was going to play it, and I was going to direct it because I was like, look, at this point in my career in filmmaking, I just need to make a feature that's good, and I know that I can pull this role off. But looking back at it, I don't think I could have. I really don't think I could have. And when I posted it and Jesse sent me a video audition, me and Courtney just looked at him. It was like instant. Like he had the look first, but then what he sent us for the for his video audition was the opening monologue. And not once did he have to look down at his script when he was doing that monologue. Not once. And it was just nasty and gnarly, and I was like, that's, and it needed to spew out of his mouth, and it just did. It just, man, it worked so good, so well.
Nothing against yourself, nobody can see you but me, but I don't think you have the look that you were looking for, if that makes sense.
No.
He has that look. I really think he is his character. I could see him doing this.
Yeah, it's funny. So me and Jesse, after we cast Jesse, we went up there to the house, and me and him, I was actually kind of playing the role of what Dustin ends up playing in the movie, and we did some just some test shots and things like that, because we took the cameras up there to see what things would look like, see what he would look like up there at the house. And I have that footage still. I cut together a whole minute and a half long trailer basically to try and sell the movie to be able to get money for budget and stuff like that. And we did. It helped a little bit. We got some. But yeah, I looked at that stuff and I was like, there's no way I could have done that. There's no way.
Okay, but before we let you go, because everybody has to answer my fun questions. So, okay. First one's easy. Your favorite film?
My favorite film. It's kind of a tie, I would say, between Jurassic Park and Jaws. Yeah, I just, you know, I'm 38 years old, and it's just that time period in my life and what it did to force me into the future.
Okay. Book on film that inspired you.
Book on a film that inspired me. Fargo.
Fair enough. And one film you would recommend that everybody needs to see and nobody ever has?
That's a good question.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, you're a filmmaker in a bar and people are sitting talking to you and they always want to know what you like. And you're going to mention Jaws, Jurassic. Yeah. They're like, yeah, I've seen those. But then you're like, have you seen, I don't know, Nicholas Winding Refn's, I mean, Only God Forgives would come to my mind.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to love God, Only God Forgives. I really did. But and I love the lighting. I love Ryan Gosling. By the way, I mean, I tell people all the time that Drive is probably one of my top five favorite movies of all time. But not a lot of people know about it. But it's a really good question.
Well, you can pass. It's fine.
No. I would say Blue Ruin always comes up.
Oh, yeah. Jeremy's first film, too.
Yeah. It's funny. Blue Ruin, when I saw in the theater, I didn't know what it was. And I just wanted to see a cool crime kind of thing. So we went to see it in the theater. And that night, I came home and I wrote the opening monologue to Where Sleeping Dogs Lie. And just kind of just funny.
Well,
but yeah, I think I'd probably go to Blue Room.
Since we made it through a whole interview and I haven't really talked about your film at all, other than filmmaking, which I think we're perfect. Tell everybody where they can find this film and learn some more about it that I didn't tell them about.
you can find it on, it'll be on iTunes July 7th. So about 3 weeks away now, I guess. And after that, right now it's a little up in the air, but it definitely will be on iTunes July 7th. There's some other things that are happening. We're also trying to get physical copies printed right now so that we can sell those on Amazon. But at the very least, it'll be on Prime a few weeks after that.
Well, thank you for your time and have a great evening.
Dude, I really appreciate it, man. Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye. Hey, I just want to say thank you for listening to this great interview. We have more on our website at www.extrafeatures.ca. And if you enjoyed it, can you please go to iTunes and leave us an iTunes review and like us on our Facebook page? Thank you.